Valentine's in your place.
We got, all right. Good morning. Meeting's called to order, and before proceeding with any business, Mr. Cook, you have a statement to make.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, it's in there somewhere. It's the same, it's one you always make, bud.
He can't.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the Office of Secretary of State as required by Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act, and I would like for this fact to be noted in the official record of this meeting.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Cook. Before we begin our committees today, I'd like to announce that our good friend Peter Holt is going to pick up the gauntlet from our good friend Ned Holmes, who, as you know, has gone to the tech stop and is a great loss to this commission, but a great addition, I think, to tech stop. And Peter, I've asked to chair the Finance Committee, and I know he's going to do a great job, and he's been well briefed by Ned Holmes. And he has Ned's phone number, home phone number, email, and everything else. So, Peter, I'll let you chair your Finance Committee. And if you need the gavel,
I don't need a gavel.
No, you don't need it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to give you. You're not ready for a gavel.
I'm not ready.
I'll let you work that gavel.
You can be
making
a lot of noise.
Okay.
Danger for that gavel.
All right, Chairman Holt.
Okay, Chairman Holt. I like that. The first order of business is the approval of the previous committee meeting minutes, which have already been distributed. Is there a motion for approval?
So moved.
Second.
Okay. That's by Donato Ramos first and second by Robert Brown. Committee item number one, land and water plan update. Mr. Cook, will you please make your presentation?
Thank you, Mr. Holt. As I believe you are aware, the State Auditor's Office has been conducting an audit of our state parks operations in an effort to evaluate the funding needs as it relates to our $85 million LAR request. The auditors are currently wrapping up their field work and will be issuing a report by mid-March, we understand. Just a couple of notes on the legislative front. We saw and we have provided you copies of the Senate committee appointments made by the Lieutenant Governor. So we've got that one in hand and are making sure that we're folks are aware of where we are and what our issues are. We also, will be expecting, of course, the appointments made by the House, by the Speaker, in the very near future. We hear tomorrow, we hear Friday, so probably something like that, and we anxiously await that. As you may know, there have been five bills of some variety filed regarding the sporting goods sales tax and its application to our state parks funding needs. House Bill 6, submitted by Chairman Hardy Hildebrand, now has something over 80 co-authors signed on to it, and the last I saw, I think it was about 83, 84. So that proposed legislation has got a tremendous amount of support, basically dedicates all of the sporting goods sales tax to our state parks request. Late last week, our friend Senator Craig Estes, Wichita Falls, filed Senate Bill 252, which is a mirror bill of that same HB 6. And I know that, again, in the Senate, there's a lot of support for that. There's also bills a little bit different twist filed by Representative Sid Miller, Representative Keno Flores, and Representative David Leibowitz. And some of them have very much similarity. Some of them have a little bit different tweak to them. We have for you, the last thing that I have for you, we have finalized, and Lydia and her shop have finished and prepared and have ready for mail out our FY06 annual report, a report that we do each year on our operations, our strategic goals, our expenditures, kind of how everything's going. I think you'll find it interesting, and like I said, that'll be mailed out this week. And that's all I have.
Thank you. Committee item number two, Texas State Railroad update. Mr. Walt Dabney.
Thank
Chairman and Commissioners, my name is Walt Dabney. I'm State Parks Director, and I'm going to introduce a speaker from Ruskin Palestine in just a second. They're going to be talking about the Texas State Railroad, the Texas Railroad. It's the largest and probably most complex unit of the state park system. You've been aware that we have been struggling over the last number of years trying to keep the train running and trying to keep it fixed up and operating properly. We've kind of come to the end of the road. We are operating fully through FY07, and we are working with our friends over in the Rust-Palestine area to see what can be done to perpetuate the operation of the Texas State Railroad. As you know, we have a legislative appropriation request in that you submitted for consideration by the legislature. I want to introduce City Councilman from Palestine, Mr. Steve Presley, who is actually also the president of the Texas State Railroad Operating Agency, which we are working with as park staff, he will explain what that is. But Mr. Presley is here to talk to you and give you a briefing on where we are with the Texas State Railroad. He'll be available for any questions after that.
Commissioners, thank you very much for spending a little time to listen to us. I know you'll have a very busy agenda and have a lot of things to cover, but this is very near and dear to us, so we really appreciate you taking the time to listen. My name's Steve Presley. I'm a scientist in Palestine, and I'm a city councilman there, and grew up there and have been used to hearing that railroad whistle blow for really most all my life. Where I live, every Saturday morning when it comes in, I go out in the morning and listen to it. It's a wonderful thing to hear. You also be there to enjoy it. It's a great thing. But so we've really been interested in making sure that the railroad is saved for several legislative sessions now. We've come to Austin to battle with the department to try to get funding, additional funding for it, because it has a huge funding requirement. When we appeared before, we heard a little over a year ago that the funding was just not there to keep it operating as it was. We came down and asked for it to be extended for you to continue operations as they were. You did. And at that time, we understood that it would close January 1 of this year if further funding was not received, and that it would probably close after that altogether. We also were told both by the department and by the told by the department that it would close, told by the legislative leadership that they would not support further funding of the railroad on any long-term basis the way it had been funded in the past. So we set out to find an alternative method of operating a railroad if need arose. What we've come up with is that the cities of Palestine and Rust got together and formed, through an interlocal agreement, formed this Texas State Railroad Operating Agency, which has the powers of municipalities, so it can deal with governments and all. And that was an outgrowth from our old task force that we had first established to just gather the information. The operating agency has gone out and done what it needed to do to find credible operators that could operate this railroad at a profit long term. If you'll open your notebooks, just this first page, we just briefly discuss how we were formed, and that we've developed a plan to ensure the long-term operations of the Texas State Railroad outside of the normal fluctuations in the state budget. And we know that those are things that we cannot do. We can't make this successful without this department and the staff and you commissioners, and we know that. If you'll flip on the under tab one, the operating agency, we feel that the best option for the railroad for long-term funding, or the option that is most practical to us, appears to be one where we would find a credible private entity that would come in and operate the railroad, but under the guidance and control of a local public agency, a local public authority in this case. It would be a district created by the legislature that would, a state created authority that would control the operations, oversee any private operator that would operate this. We have released an RFQ, request for qualifications, for operators that requires them to have a lot of things. That RFQ, the entire RFQ, is under tab 2 if you want to flip to that. And the qualifications in there, but just briefly, I'll try to keep everything limited, and then if you have questions, we'll go into it more deeply. But basically, we're saying you must have experience operating a railroad. You must have operating a profitable railroad. You must have financial strength enough to continue with these operations as we do this. We have a lot of requirements in there on things that they must do to protect the assets, to preserve the history, to preserve historical accuracy in the railroad. All of those things are important to us. And our preliminary work with operators, we have found that we can, their preliminary estimates were that their long-term costs of both capital improvements and temporary subsidies to get them over the hump until they get their ridership up is probably going to be in the range of $12 to $15 million total, long-term, forever. When we get the final RFQ in, it may even be less than that, and that's what we're hoping for, but we won't know that until we've gotten that in and done the final negotiations with them. As of today, we have three operators that have told us they will submit bids, that in that price range they feel they can easily come in and turn it into a profitable operation. And that most of that money, we're expecting probably a very small amount of that money would go to operating subsidies, and the large portion of that money would go back to do rail and right-of-way repair that is going to have to be done anyway. Now, our plan is to leave the rails and right-of-way in state hands with Parks and Wildlife, hopefully, and so that what we're really doing is we're asking this private entity to come in, spend state money to repair state assets, and then we're also asking them, and since that's not enough to take care of it, right now the Parks and Wildlife Department estimates there's about $30 million worth of work that needs to be done out there. We're going to basically give them $10 or $12 million and say the rest of it comes out of your pocket, but you have to do it if you're going to take this railroad. So that's what we're asking someone to come in and do, is pay that much money out of their pocket for the privilege of operating this railroad. And right now we have three credible operators to do that. One operator that has said they're going to submit a bid is American Heritage Railways. They currently operate the Durango-Silverton Railway in Colorado, the Great Smoky Mountains Railway in western North Carolina. Another one is, we just got this one this week. I'm not as familiar with the second group. It's the Sierra. I think they operate the Sierra Railroad, the Skunk Train, another train, and then they've just gotten the Virginia Truckee and Nevada, and then there's a third group that has said they're going to submit, and we're expecting probably one more. But we have three, and again, we're requiring that they have multi-years of experience coming in, they have a good financial statements and background, and we'll research all of that to assure ourselves that we're getting, that anyone that we would invite in would be profitable. It was our understanding that was what we really needed to do to be able to, that the legislature was instructing us to do, to come up with this alternative, and that's what we've done. The last thing that I wanted to point out to you is the economic benefits under tab 3. At that amount of money, basically what it boils down to is that we are in a rural area. Rural economies are not like the metropolitan areas, and it's much more difficult to stimulate a rural economy economically than it is of the metropolitan areas. There are very few things that you can get into. You don't just move a factory down there. You don't do a lot of things because it's harder to find people that are qualified from our area to do things. This is one thing that can be done that's a great economic stimulus to our area. The advantage of having a local public-private partnership is that all of the projections that we see from these private operators are that they will triple or quadruple the ridership and double the employment in our area. They will also expend large sums of money on advertising, bringing people in. Those people, those additional riders, people that would come in, are not just going to ride the train. They bring them in for a weekend experience is the way they view it, which gets them there overnight. They're going to spend the entire weekend there, and they spend a lot more than just money on the railroad. That pumps a lot of dollars, not only from nearby areas, but from outside into our local, into our regional economy, actually. And so it's very important for us to have this extra economic engine, so to speak, to drive our economies forward. And again, they view turning it to profitability by increasing that ridership, those ridership numbers. How do they do that? One of the easy ways is they bring in special events. Thomas the Tank Engine, the Polar Express, the little engine that could. Those are some of the things that they will bring in. Their American Heritage told me that their Thomas the Tank Engine events in North Carolina and in Durango this past year brought in over 20,000 riders at each location for just that event. Well, you know, that's more than a third of our annual ridership for one event. So when they can contract with people like that we've had a difficult time accomplishing as a state, when they can do that as a private business and bring all those riders in, it gives them the advantage and those ridership numbers, so they got the extra income to cover that fixed cost that they've got. So those are some of the things that they can do. And there are a lot of other things. Y'all are aware that as a private business that we can do that as a state we can't, that make it increase the efficiency some. So we really view it as a stimulus to our economy. One last thing that we're expecting of the private operator is that they work closely with the Texas Film Commission. We have been as well. There have been films made out there. Right now their budget is not enough. They don't have enough staff really to handle films being done as it currently exists. And we feel, the Texas Film Commission feels, that's a huge boost to the state economy if we're able to continue to use the Texas State Railroad for filming purposes. They think we will lose about 2 films a year. Average film now is about 50-something million in expenditures. They think without the state railroad, we will lose that many films a year to the state of Texas. And just as a note, they say that it's not that we're going to have 2 films filmed out there. They said, their explanation was, if there's a film that's being filmed somewhere in the state that even has a 10-second clip at a railroad, they've got to find a railroad somewhere. This is it. This is what we will use. And so if we don't have that railroad available to them, they're going to just move to another state that has one. And that's what happens. So it's not that they'll film that many there, but they will film more there if we're able to. Behind the tab 3, behind my letter on the front, just the description of what it is the study that was done by Crompton, actually Boswell and Crompton. This is a follow-up study to the one that the legislature had, I guess, commissioned them to do a couple of years before. It's got newer numbers in it. We had this done so that the legislature could see what happens if the numbers have risen, how much more impact there is. And if you extend this on out, there's about double the impact with about a 50% increase in ridership. If you extend that on out, then you can see that there's a much greater economic impact by doing that, by having the increased ridership from the local private partnership. And then the last page is that letter from the Texas Film Commission explaining some of what they think is going on. That's under tab 4. Tab 5 is the indices. The first one is Stone Consulting. That's the group that we hired. There is a consulting group an engineering firm that deals with tourist railroads. That's their primary business, is in the business of consulting to tourist railroads. They deal with states and other public agencies primarily and working to get tourist railroads back on their feet, well, mostly private groups now. And that's tab 1 is the firm. Appendix tab 2 is the engineer that we're working with, Randy Gustafson. Under tab S3 is a marketing sketch that American Heritage prepared. This was just a sample one they prepared for us of things that they think they might do if they were to get the railroad from us. You can flip through that and see with branding and promotions and special events and how they would do some of the things they would do. You can pretty quickly see that they think things through and have and do have a plan for making it successful. That's pretty much where we are and what we've done. What questions do you have? Yes, sir.
On an annual basis, what is your operating budget? Just so I fully understand, what does it cost you on an annual basis just to operate the railroad? And what kind of shortfall are we currently
We've reduced the budget in 07. It's $1.8 million, and we're bringing in a little over $1 million right now in revenue. We've actually had a very good year this year. Our gift shop is the biggest gift. The railroad gift shop is the biggest one in the system now, doing extremely well.
So you're saying the shortfall is $800,000, about?
Of the existing budget, which is not the budget we need to run the railroad.
What is the budget that we need to run the railroad?
I can get you those figures, but if you figure the total amount of repair costs and operating dollars that it needs to be increased, it needs to be between $5 and $6 million a year.
In other words, Walt, the capital expenditure to bring it up to the level that it needs to be is how much more?
As Steve mentioned earlier, if you went in and just fixed it, you're talking about approximately $30 million to go in and do the capital. If the capital work was out of the way, if we had the railroad in good shape, we could maintain it and operate it, especially if we could do advertising and that kind of thing and increase the ridership, I think we could get it up a lot closer than it is now, but you could still be, you'd be operating it at somewhere between $3 and $4 million, and you might get a couple of million or so in revenue, at least the way it's going now. We've not been able to advertise. We have not had a single dollar to advertise this railroad, which is a liability for us, a disadvantage to us.
If you look at the numbers, Mr. Brown, going back to your question, look at numbers over the last 3 or 5 years, you know, again, as Walt said, we've had very, very little maintenance money, major maintenance money. We've done what we could with our Prop 8 money and those kinds of things. But in operating, in fuel and personnel and those kinds of daily issues that we deal with, you're looking at a difference between operating, as Walt says, between operating and revenues of about $1.2 million, $1.1 million, $1.3 million. At where we have been the last several years, the last 4 or 5 years. The maintenance, the wall that we're up against here is we put in our legislative appropriation request approximately $4 million per year for many years. But, of course, this request is for the 2 years, a little over $4 million a year to initiate these major repairs, which is replacement of the rails, replacement of the cross ties, engine repairs, as you can see in Steve's document. There's a number of the engines that need a considerable amount of work. And, I want to thank Steve and a group of folks. I see Dale Brown, Charles Hassel from Rusk. We've worked with these folks for many years and really very closely. Walt and Scott and folks have worked with these folks. They are trying to help. They're trying to get an option out there as directed by the legislature, get an option to determine if that option is viable. And that's what we're looking at. I think that's an important step.
Peter? Yes, sir. Mr. Preston, first of all, I want to thank you for taking on this job. I remember visiting with former Senator Todd Staples on this, and I know he's been a big help on and encouragement to you. And a lot of people talk, and your group actually started to work. So I want to first thank you for that. Let me ask you a couple of questions about how this operates in other states, and I'll just use American Heritage as an example because it sounds like they've done this, and I always like to find somebody in the private sector who actually knows how to do what it is we're trying to get done. And, in the other states, in Colorado and in North Carolina, does American Heritage work under the same template that you described, where there would be a quasi-state agency that oversees them, or some sort of railroad district, or How does that work?
No, they own the railroad outright. So they're responsible in those instances for all operations of everything, and it must be profitable with no subsidies whatsoever. That's why we feel that that model would work with us. The advantage we have is that we can make sure that they comply with what needs may occur as far as the state or local government's need to make sure that that it's kept in good shape. They don't just, you know, come in and gut the thing and sell assets off if we have a downturn in the economy and things like that. And we'll have provisions in there that don't allow them to do that. So that, whereas if it's purely a private business and things go south on them because of events beyond their control even, then in Colorado or North Carolina, they'd be able to just close it.
It could essentially be a concession or a long-term lease, or how would it be structured?
That's in the RFQ, we requested their proposals to their plan of how they would propose to do this. What our overall plan is that we don't feel like, number one, nobody's going to get the rails and the right of way. That's got to, in our opinion, that has to stay in state hands. That's the most valuable part of the asset. We feel like we can't, that it's not good for us to give that up. So that needs to stay with the state under all conditions. The rest of the assets, we would like to have under the control of the operating agency, but actually we don't want to give anything away. But what we're really looking at is that they've got this huge expenditure that needs to be done on improvements and all, and that $30 million basically is a today dollar figure, not a figure that includes any kind of inflation factors. So, you know, it's probably bigger than that. And we're looking at that thinking, we don't know what the legislature is going to do. If the legislature comes in and says, okay, we'll fully fund all your requests, then they may end up owning nothing and they're leasing everything. On the other hand, if the legislature comes in and says, well, we're going to only fund this little bit over here, then we may be in the position where the only way we can get a qualified operator is to trade some assets to them that they can have to offset some of the expenditures that they're going to have to pay on the capital improvement side that the state won't pay. And that's kind of what it boils down to. Our preference is for the group to, under most conditions, for the group to only lease assets and the assets to stay in public hands the whole time. We thought about it though, and that there are a bunch of cars and equipment that the state now owns that they don't use on a regular basis and is basically falling into a greater state of disrepair because there's not enough money in the budget to put a building over to protect it, for example. And one of the advantages of them owning some of the rolling stock is that we can, if they own it, we can require that they not allow it to deteriorate, which now we don't have the ability to do with state ownership. And so a lot of the rolling stock continues to deteriorate. So it gives us a way, if they own it, to protect it. So the answer to the question is we don't know yet which way it will go because it will depend on the legislative funding.
You'd indicated you had this on a fast track and you're trying to just get something done by the end of February. Did I see that in your presentation?
Yes, we issued the RFQ in January the 12th, I think it was. The RFQs are due back to us February 12th, and we're going to announce selection on February 23rd. It has a lot of qualification. I mean, it's kind of a cross between an RFQ and an RFP, so they've got to have a lot more detail in there than a normal RFQ. But at that point, then, we will begin negotiations with them and hope to have those completed by mid-March. On all of the details of a contract, hope to have a contract in place with dollars that they would require when and how the whole thing would be administered by mid-March. And that's when we're really going to need, if we get through that stage, we don't know if we'll really know by that point where the legislature is going to be. And we hope to really have the department help us in that process to make sure that whatever protections are needed in there. I mean, we've got the consulting group to protect us, and we've got the attorneys to protect us, and our Economic Development Corporation people and all working on it. But we still want the department in that when we get to that part of the negotiations, to make sure that things are run smoothly, that the, if transition is required, that that be done smoothly and all of that. So at that point, it's, we really feel it would be important to get as much help as we can from the department.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Presley, thank you for coming down.
Sure.
I would like, you know, what I'm trying to get fixed in my head is that we have what we've been told, we have a $130 million asset with the Texas State Railroad. Now, can you tell me in your opening statement, can you tell me who they was who said they would not fund the Texas State Railroad?
Yes, sir. I certainly can. To clarify, I think it was not that they would not, that they did not say we will not fund it. What I thought I said and what I meant to say was that the funding would be unlikely from the legislature, that they did not feel that there would be adequate support from the legislature to fund this long term. Okay?
Okay, now, you're still using the pronoun.
I would be happy to clarify that. That came from the representatives of the Speaker's office, Don Green, and of the Lieutenant Governor's office, Glenn Brunson, in conversations that we had with them, and in conversations that we had with Todd Kirchball, Representative Hildebrand's aide.
Okay.
It also came from Senator Staples, and it came from Representative Byron Cook. And then we have a letter from Director Cook, dated March 3rd or something like that, that says, it's the last tab.
Let me read your letter.
It says, no, it's not the last tab. It's the next last tab. It says, it is recommended that January 1, 2007 TSR be transferred to another entity for operation and management. If this transfer does not take place by January 1, 2007, TPWD will begin operating TSR as a static historical display at the Rust State Park and Palisade State Park. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that was written in response to the fact that there wasn't any other way to do it because there was no funding.
That's correct.
And either y'all figured out a way to save it or it's closed because we don't have the money to do it.
That's correct.
So that's the basis under which we felt there was no funding available.
Okay.
All those politicians told us that and the department told us that.
Okay. One other item here. Has the issue of the right-of-ways been thoroughly investigated, each one of those?
Yes, sir. Our attorney has and has talked with others, and we have a specialist municipal attorney that deals in municipal law exclusively, and they're his firm does. And he's looked into it and felt that it would be fine to put it under the auspices of the authority, but we still feel like that it needs to stay with Texas Parks and Wildlife regardless. If it stays with Texas Parks and Wildlife, there is no issue because they continue to own it. So you own it now and there's not an issue. If you continue to own it, there still won't be an issue.
And going back to the asset, $130 million, will there be any safeguards as to what you mentioned about older historic cars that somebody wanting to trade them off and so forth and so on?
Yes, sir. There absolutely will be. On the older cars, if we are required to transfer or feel that it's in the best interest of the railroad to transfer any rolling stock assets over to a private operator, several provisions would be in there to protect us. The first would be, and we've already talked to them about these provisions, and American Heritage is who we've talked to the most. They've been most active in this, and they've agreed to these. The first would be that they would be required to keep everything up, maintain them. They would only achieve title to this over an extended period of time of 6 to 8 years. They would not receive any assets up front. They would earn them out as they met performance goals on ridership increases and activities toward maintaining and keeping up and the railroad, the rails, the ties, and all of that. So if they don't meet those maintenance and attendanceship requirements, they don't get the ownership. So it's stretched out over long periods of time.
What happens after 6 to 8 years?
At any time in there, we also have told them we will have buyback privileges at the lowest offered price to anyone, and that all the assets that they have, any rolling stock, cannot leave the railroad ever, except for temporary purposes, temporary use, and we'll have some time limits in there and or things like that, with the exception that the authority would have the ability to amend that if necessary. If we could trade a non-working engine that we had or two non-working engines for a good working engine somewhere, then it might be in the best interest of the railroad to do that, then we would want to have that ability to do that. But that would fall to the governmental entity that would make that decision, not the private operator. So even if they own it, they have to keep it there, and they have to keep it up.
You mentioned Senator Staples, Agriculture Commissioner Staples now, and we have a new commissioner, Senator Nichols.
Yes.
What has Senator Nichols said about this process?
We've met with Senator Nichols last Friday for 2.5 hours. We met with Senator Nichols the previous Friday for 3 hours, bringing him up to speed on what needs to be done. What he told Charles Hassel and I, Charles is the vice president of our group, and we'll have some things to say in a minute, but he told us that he feels the best way to proceed with this, if I understand him correctly, and I'm having to quote what someone else says, so please, in the second hand now, so please, if I have a little inaccuracy, I apologize. But my understanding of what he told me was that he felt that the best way to proceed with this was to move forward with two tracks. One is full funding just like it is for the legislature to go forward and get a commitment out of them to spend what everybody estimates to be $40 to $50 million over the next 10 years, and then ongoing expenses after that, or that if they're not going to commit to that, then let's save it by putting the $12 million in new money in that we need now. And so he said we need to proceed with both simultaneously, because by the time we would get the lack of commitment out of the legislative body for the larger sum, if we just start this process at the same time, it'll be too late. We have to go ahead and introduce the bills, and get the process working on both down both methods at the same time, and then the legislature makes their decision on which method they choose to follow. And that's what he's told us that he wants to do.
So you're saying we go to the legislature and say we would like to have our exceptional item.
The LAR, yes, sir.
Out of the LAR.
$11.8 million.
$11.8. And if you don't give us the exceptional item to the Texas Parks and Wildlife, then we want you to hand over $11.8 million to the new operator.
No, it would not be to the new operator. It would be to the authority.
To the authority.
That's okay. Correct. And the authority would be responsible for doling it out to them a little bit at a time as they spent the money first and were reimbursed for appropriate expenses under the contract. So they don't get any money without having spent money.
So the $11.8 million that you would ask to go to the authority would only be every time that $11.8 million is reduced, it paid to the order of the new train operator, nobody else.
I would presume that would be the way it would work. I really haven't thought through that exact question. But any of the monies that would come in you know, they're going to have to prove up most of that money that would come to us. And actually, the original estimate for our group was $11.6 million. It's a one-time expenditure of the legislature, and they're done. If they do it for the, if they do the LAR, they're spending $11.8 million this biennium, that much again next biennium, and five bienniums in a row. And that's why we felt like when faced with that, we're going to spend that amount of money five times in a row, or we can spend it once. We just felt like that the legislature is going to say, that's not even the question. And but we've, so, you know, how they won't get the money, no one would get money without having it been a justified expense under the contract, and the contract is going to be an open and visible and ready for anybody to examine before the legislature even votes. So if they don't like it, or this department doesn't like it or anything, then we can change it or see that we just can't arrive at a good agreement. So there won't be anything hidden about it. It'll be open to everybody to help be constructive and make that railroad better.
So it's only the 11.8 exceptional item, the LAR, that you're asking for. You're not asking for any other annual increments.
At this time, we're not. It would be really nice if we could get some additional funding. If we could get that extra $500,000 that's in the budget already out of Parks and Wildlife to do, to ensure ourselves some long-term capital improvements, or, you know, have set up a fund for emergencies and things like that, that would be really wonderful. But I doubt that Director Cook would like to give us that $500,000 a year. I think he probably has other places to spend it. But I would be happy to ask for it if you're encouraging me to.
Chairman Fitzsimmons, if I could just clarify one thing. Again,
will you introduce yourself?
I'm Charles Hassel. I'm the Vice President of the agency. We've been working closely with Senator Nichols, Representative Hobson, and Representative Cook on legislation that will need and have to be passed if we go this route, if the legislature does not fully fund the railroad for the state to continue to operate it. We have proposed legislation that we've been working on. We are having a town hall meeting in Jacksonville in Cherokee County this Friday to make this public to the public and answer any questions. Immediately after the town hall meeting, sometime next week, we will be posting a notice. It's my understanding a 30-day notice has to be posted in the papers before the bill is filed, and then the bill will be filed. It has to be filed, as I understand, before March 9th. And that's why we're proceeding this way. In the event that the legislature does not fully fund the train for the state to operate it. And we also believe that if it became a static park, then it would make it even more difficult for us to find a private entity to take it over after it's already closed. We need the train is in good operating condition. The companies that have come to look at it have been very impressed with the condition of the properties, the trains, et cetera. And if it becomes a static park, then it would be difficult for someone to come in and take it over.
Mr. Graham?
Have you, as a group of counties, have you looked at forming some type of regional bonding authority that maybe could help you underwrite part of the cost?
No, we have not. We talked to the Rural Rail Transportation District. That there's one that's in serves several counties, but not Anderson County. I'm not sure if Cherokee County is in it or not. They said they would talk with us, and we briefly discussed some issues early in the process. And through the Rural Rail Transportation Districts really are not designed to do what we're proposing to do. That possibility always exists, I'm sure. I just don't know how we would do that. We just haven't approached it that way, honestly. I'd also like to introduce the group. If us could have a group from Palestine or us stand to show you that we do, there actually are people interested in it. and then we have some legislative people behind, from Representative, if y'all would please stand, from Representative Cook's office, from Stephen Albright, from Senator Nichols' office, and then Kelly Strickling from the Department of Agriculture, now with Senator Staples. And she and Kelly has been in on this since the very beginning and really has done a vast amount of work in getting this done. She and the Senator Staples' office helped us with a fundraiser. Actually, they did the fundraiser for us and raised about $100,000 for us to be able to afford to pay the consultants, pay the attorneys, help get the legislation written and all of that. And we thank some of y'all. I know some of you are contributors as well, and we thank you very much for that, for helping us with this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions from the commissioners?
Could I say something?
This is Dale Brown. He's our city manager, and is on the he's the secretary of the operating agency as well.
Speak about the bonding. The problem is Cherokee County and Anderson County have a total population of less than 100,000, and that's counting probably 10,000 convicts, something like that, inmates in the various prisons.
About 18,000. We have five prisons in our county, and Cherokee County has one for the six prison population.
The two biggest employers in Anderson County are the prison system and two Walmart distribution centers, none of which pay high rates of pay. They are not wealthy counties, and there's probably no way those two counties can support a large bond issue. That's why bringing in this is being used as an economic device to help not only those two counties, but even the surrounding counties, because there's just no way. For instance, there's been discussion about using hotel-motel tax. Palestine probably gets 90% of the hotel-motel tax within the two counties, something like that. That's a total of $300,000 a year. So our revenue sources are just too limited to deal with this.
And in fact, we spend the majority of the advertising that is done to the Texas State Railroad, the majority of it is done by the Convention Visitors Bureau in Palestine right now already. So thank you for that answer. I'm glad that you're within our group. Have some good answers for us. Other questions?
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you very much. You're welcome to keep the notebook. If you have other questions, you're welcome to call us, contact us. I'd be happy to give you my cell phone number if anyone would like to take it. 903-731-3007. You can call me anytime, day or night. I'm a pharmacist. I don't mind it. I'm used to it.
Now the public record.
Yes. I get so many calls all the time. So I don't mind. Thank you all.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve. Committee item number 3, financial review. Ms. Mary Fields.
Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, I'm Mary Fields, Chief Financial Officer, and I'm here to provide the financial review. The focus of the presentation today will be to provide a year-end close in revenue and budget status for fiscal year 2006, and to give you an overview of the first quarter of fiscal year 2007 budget and revenue status. So we'll start out with the 2006 year-end close. Starting off with state park receipts as of the end of that fiscal year, we were up at $33.95 million. We were up 5.5% or $1.75 million over the prior year's collection. In reviewing the categories of park receipts shown there on the park or on the bar chart, all of the categories were up. Most notably was the entrance fees and the park passes. In looking at the boat revenue as of the end of fiscal year 2006, we ended at $20.7 million. This was slightly down from the prior year, as you can see, at 1.5% or $316,000. The boat registrations were down by a couple of percent, the revenue there. Titles were slightly up at just 0.2%, and sales tax was down by 1.8%. We do continue to transfer 15% of the registration and titling revenue to Fund 64, and for the year that amounted to $2.7 million. The license sales revenue, moving into that category, it was also down a little bit from the prior year at $85.9 million. It was down 1.4% or $1.3 million. As you can see on the various categories there on the slide, the other category was slightly up. Hunting was up 2.3%, fishing was down 3.9%, and combo sales were down 1.7%. We did add a little further detail to this slide that I wanted to just talk about briefly here. As you can see, we've got the dark and light green for hunting and the dark and light blue for fishing. We went ahead and split the non-resident hunting fees versus the resident hunting fees, and then we also did it for the fishing categories. What's interesting here, and what you'll see on the next slide, is in the hunting category, 60% of that hunting revenue is coming from the non-resident category. On the next slide, you'll see about it represents about 15% of the total number of licenses sold.
All right. I was just going to suggest on the fishing, you might explain with the boat registrations, too. You think a lot of it had to do with the weather and etc. That seems to be where we're down the most.
That's correct. Yeah. Gas prices, were higher, and we did have some drought conditions. So that did impact fishing, and it did impact the boat.
Mm-hmm.
So looking then just at the items sold, again, we were at $2.69 million, down 1.5%. This correlates pretty closely to the revenue decline that I just talked about. And this is another slight change we made here, which we discussed in the last time I covered a financial review. We did go ahead and exclude the active duty military licenses. Those had been included in the count before, but they don't bring revenue with them. Those are issued for free. So when you take that out, the numbers correlate a little bit better.
How many of those are there?
As a speaking test, you're right on track. We issued 38,140 of those to the active duty military.
When we use this data to track trends of the number of people hunting, are we adding those back in? You maintain them somewhere else?
We do maintain them, but for presentation purposes, what was happening is that the number sold looked higher, but it didn't correlate with the revenue. So when we talked about this last time, I said I'll take it out for comparative purposes, but I will note that number.
Okay. But that 38,000 is all combo hunting and fishing.
It's super combo sales or super combo licenses issued to active duty military.
Okay.
And, if we had charged for that, the revenue would have been roughly 2.4.
That was better than 1% of total. The total's 2.6, yeah.
And when we talk
big
about
1.5%,
it's growing, and we'll talk about that when I get to 07. We've seen some growth in that category.
And the fishing without a license in state parks, do you have any idea what the impact is on that on fishing license sales?
The fishing license sales?
No, the fishing in state parks without a license. Do you know what impact that is?
I don't have specific numbers on that, but our sense is that it's not really impacting the fishing revenue substantially.
It's not because people weren't going to buy a license, it's just they weren't going to fish.
You see, it's 07 in our first quarter, it's going back up.
Right.
Okay. Another thing on the military that I just found out this morning is that there's not any real way we can tell active duty versus retired or reservist or whatever. And you can't, the military won't give you that information. So essentially, anybody that's flashing anything shows military, we're giving them a license. You could have a lot of retired, for example.
Mm-hmm.
My guess is that's what you're getting.
With the time to hunt and fish.
At least they're out there.
Yeah.
fairly sizable amount.
The other number of licenses sold,
right.
we have over 200 licenses that we sell. So both are various permits and alligator ones.
That was one of them. In the aggregate, they're a lot, but individually, they're small.
They are. Okay. Yes. I mean, as far as total revenue, they're not a large amount, but there's a large number sold.
Their numbers are up,
and the revenue was up slightly there. And I looked at it. There's just so many of them. It's just such a spread and variation among those licenses.
That large amount.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir, Don.
With regards to the non-resident fishing, is that going up or down?
The non-resident fishing. It's running pretty close. It's closely correlated to the revenue. It's about 10%. And
this year as compared to the year. I'm just wondering if our Texas fisheries are attracting non-residents to the state. I'm trying to see if there's a trend.
It looks about the same, doesn't it?
It is very close to the same. And
what slide is that on?
It seems to be discussing the various categories on the numbers sold. If I'm recalling it, it was about 11-12%, and it's still roughly 11-12%. It's very closely correlated.
Right, but not in the same proportion as the non-resident hunting, obviously. It's
well, and also that license is not as high. The non-resident hunting license sells for $300. The general non-resident hunting, the non-resident fishing licenses. What is it?
50.
So that's part of what you're saying is just the price differential.
Okay. But from a volume standpoint, would the percentages be comparable or you don't know? In other words, I'm trying to quantify is how many people are coming from out of state generally to fish in Texas, maybe, as compared to hunters from out of state hunting in Texas. See if there's any correlation.
Tell us about freshwater.
Well, the Dan's fishing tournament is going to track them. We're going to get a lot more in.
That's one reason I'm asking that question.
To give you some perspective, there was, in looking at all of the licenses sold, the number of fishing in all the categories was a little over a million. 95,000 of them were non-resident. And the year before it was 93,000 out of over a million.
In what, hunting or fishing?
In fishing.
A little less than 9%. Okay, so then if we take the same numbers, or the same, what's the percentage for hunting, non-resident hunting?
And those percentages that I just mentioned, those numbers we're looking at 9.5% in 05 and 12% in 04. Okay. For hunting, we're looking at in 06, a little over 75,000 sold out of 509,000. So it's roughly 15%.
A little higher for hunting than fishing.
That's right.
About
300. Yeah. I think this gets to marketing.
Yes.
And obviously, you know, bringing non-residents in is bringing real big bucks in, too.
That's right. And our fisheries in Texas are so great that perhaps we could increase our non-resident fishing fees and promote it a little more. That's where I'm coming from. I think we have a great opportunity in our fisheries in Texas to generate more revenues and bring in more people.
Donato, I agree with you wholeheartedly, and I would like to. I'm going to hold something up. I don't have enough copies of it for everybody to see, but I'm going to ask Gene. Gene McCarty did a marvelous job for me. I asked him, and this was a gargantuan work, and he did last year. I asked him to give me a license sale history for the last 20 years. And Gene, in his detail, I mean to tell you, he detailed them out. And it was a gargantuan job. The picture is that we are running flat. with a little tilt, this being just a slight tilt down, but we're running flat. And you can't, and the only way we can increase our goods and services when you're running flat and figuring inflation is to increase your price. So we've been living off of price increases, and we haven't been selling any more goods. And I would think that sometime in the near future, Peter, I would like to have all of this information given to everybody. And I would like to see if we could set out a particular group of people to do a study on this, because what I am seeing is frightening, because the only way we can get more dollars to offer more services is to raise our fees. And even Stanley Marcus found out that always did not work.
John, are those, you talking about hunting fees or fishing fees?
This is everything. Every fee. This includes,
let me get to the second page here. Oh, things, everything that we sell, you know,
jackrabbit permits,
whatever it is, we don't have a permit. I mean, every single license and permit that we sell is in this.
And I really think that we need to take a look at it.
Just add something to that. I agree with you, John, but I think there's another component as well, and that's the programs that are currently being developed by staff, and they're doing, Phil and I have been involved in some of them, as other commissioners have, and certainly you have, and I think they're doing a marvelous job of putting some programs together that we'll be hearing more about in the next few meetings, that will contribute a lot toward increasing recreational outdoor hunting opportunities. So I think that's, I think it'll be important to focus on what we have in the pipeline and under development as well.
Yeah, and I didn't go into Commissioner Parker's point too, though, is I think that, you know, do we need to focus on marketing? And you've got two issues, of course. Obviously, in-state is the biggest single thing we should do. It takes parts of my life, but also what's interesting is non-residential really caught my eye. You're talking about real dollars coming in from non-residents. Way to keep reaching out and telling the world what a great place this is in the state of Texas to hunt fish. So.
But the biggest challenge that we have, Peter, is within our metropolitan centers.
Yeah.
Getting those young people out and into outdoor experiences.
The
best way to do that is to have a park system. I don't believe that people just wake up one day and decide they're going to go hunt. They're fish. They have to have some background in the outdoors. So I think this is where you integrate the need for a park system that, you know, as our studies have been close to the urban areas, so that it becomes part of people's everyday lifestyle, quality of life. But, you know, back to Dan's point, I think it's really interesting. See, there are some bright spots. You look at the number of acres under management, under wildlife management plans. You look at the hunting days and available. You look at the fishing species available. You look at saltwater, the growth in saltwater angling. There are some bright spots that show some real growth that we need to concentrate on. And I think Dan's right. It takes time to ramp up, but we're definitely providing more opportunity.
And Dan has some excellent ideas going along with that, especially in the hunting.
Do you have the saltwater numbers broken out with the saltwater stand? Because, you know, at one time they were showing us some numbers of the number of new saltwater anglers every year. It was a pretty impressive number. You remember that?
Yeah,
that's growing, and we're flat, and where are we losing?
Yeah.
There are numerous saltwater packages and like three or four together, and then there's three or four freshwater, and I'd be happy to pull those numbers for you and provide them to you next.
Well, I would just—it just didn't seem consistent with what I heard before in the growth of saltwater angling. If it's growing, and where's McKinney? I can't remember what presentation that was that showed us the number of new saltwater anglers every year. Well, if that's increasing at a significant rate and we're flat, where are we losing?
If you look at just like the, for some comparability, if you look at just the resident freshwater versus the resident saltwater, we sold 378,000 freshwater and 86,000 saltwater. And then the all water was 116,000.
So it's hard to break out. A lot of people get all water.
How about the year before?
Yes.
The year before, there was some decline down this year. Last year we were at 104,550 for the saltwater. So it went from 104,550 down to 86,000. But we had the hurricanes on the coast.
Yeah.
And other things that happened last year.
So our fishing overall went down.
When I report on 07, you'll see that these numbers are starting to climb again.
Okay. What is the inland, the freshwater do?
What was the comparison on freshwater?
Yes. Was there a decline?
There was a decline also in that category. So we had 424,000 in 05 and 378,000 in
06. What was your all
water? The all water. 116,000 this year, 153,000 last year. So all the categories were down. And that's, I'm just looking at the main, you know, the one that told me that there are other categories.
Yes, sir. Since we're having a pricing discussion, I would think that whenever we get around to relook at pricing, we really ought to think about the price elasticity of some of these license sales. To John's point, as you are dealing with a declining market, you can raise prices on the people who are the heavy users, but you quickly lose the marginal user. If we're trying to encourage the marginal user, it's exactly what we don't want to do. Mm-hmm. We have to live out of this, but our goal is really a public policy goal. It's not a profit maximization goal. And I think particularly the out-of-state users want me to think about it because they, from a business development standpoint for the state of Texas, spend more money here than the in-state guys. We might want to think about lowering those to encourage them to come. We could raise them and get the premium hunters. Will affect the marginal hunters who are driving over from other states and where the marginal cost really matters. So we ought to give that some thought at some time we think about when we think about this.
But if you look, you've got to holler it. You've got to stand on top of the mountain and holler it.
Well, as with the military license sales for no money, when you drop the price, people show up and start buying more.
That's right.
So I think there's people out there watching those prices.
There's other benefits to the state other than just the license.
Oh, I'm all for this.
If you're running a business, you do what Mr. Parker's saying. Push the price as high as you can and maximize profit. We're not trying to maximize profit.
Well, for every one fisherman that comes into the state or hunter, and he has a great experience, he goes back, and the first thing he's going to do, he's going to brag to his neighbor and his friends.
Sure.
So then now we've got two more coming in, and so it's an investment, a long-term investment.
Commissioner Brown?
As far as on the pricing issue, we know how we price-wise compared to Louisiana, Florida, some of the other states in the country.
I personally don't know. Kim, do you have any... And we may have to pull that information for you. I know we have done some comparisons. I don't have that data with me. I don't know if Kim knows anything off the top of his head. We'll pull that data.
Governments are pretty good about taxing people who don't vote in their jurisdiction. You get high prices when you go out of state.
I
don't know about that. Yeah. They don't vote here, they're going to pay more. Usually <It's really> worse.
I'm cautious about entering into this one, but I will. we very, very, almost on an, I would say, an annual basis, if not a semi-annual basis at least, you know, watch the prices in other states, watch what it is that they're offering, what their season, bag limits, all of those kind of things are. You know, the trend that Mr. Parker spoke to is correct. You know, we're looking at a relatively flat participant base. Our revenues have increased because we've increased the fee for those exercises. We're pretty, you know, I would say to you that overall we're very reasonably priced right now for what we offer in Texas, for the opportunity offered compared to others. You know, we hear a lot of talk about we're too high, leases are too high, all those kind of things. Hunting, fishing in Texas is too expensive. You compare our numbers, those same numbers, to other states, we look great. And, you know, that does not mean we should not really market what we have because it is excellent. We have an excellent product. There is some, I think just the philosophy of the thing deserves a lot of discussion and a lot of consideration, because the quality that we offer in Texas, quality of the fishing experience, whether saltwater or freshwater, the quality of the hunting experience that we offer in Texas is part of what brings those people here. There's a lot of places they can hunt whitetail deer. There's a lot of places they can fish for bass. But we offer a quality, some of that associated with private land ownership and the control of access and those kind of things that where a person knows they're going to have that really good experience outdoors. So I think there's a lot of those factors that come into play when we consider where do we want to be 5 years from now, 10 years from now. And I think it's worth, Ms. Crowe, from the standpoint of finance, from the standpoint of everything we do, it's worth a serious look here in the next year or two. You know, I would support that, encourage that. It's worth a serious look at where do we really want to be and how do we want to get there. You know, the military licensing, you know, we support that. And the fact of the matter is, it costs us a couple of $1 million. Does it bring people out hunting that otherwise wouldn't go? Yeah, probably. I think there is a component of people, particularly people who fish some areas of fishing, some areas of hunting, where if we could do a price differentiation based on, you know, how intense you are, how serious you are about this, that's a tough one to do. That's a hard one to, when the guy walks up to the counter and goes, hey, I'm just one of them occasionally. I just go out and catch a perch, you know, off the bank every once in a while with a cane pole. I mean, it's hard to, you know, well, I rabbit hunt, or, you know, it's hard to get there. And so you got to deal with that person selling that license over the counter at Academy and Walmart, and the folks who support us in that end, that person that walks up and says, I want a license to whatever. So it's a topic that, you know, I watched it very closely for a number of years, because there was a lot of discussion about hunting and the cost of leases. But you look at the states that are predominantly public hunting lands, where they don't pay a lease, where all they got to do is walk out the door, 75-90% of the land's public land, and go hunting. There's a much steeper decline in the number of hunters. That's just where they were 25-30 years ago.
Well, the actual number than that is a percentage of the state population.
Everybody's
dropping.
In those states, there's also been rigid and steady price increases for the licenses.
It's a bookie. I mean, a little housekeeping matter. Shouldn't Peter's point be reflected somewhere that this really is military, not active duty? It's anybody with a military ID is getting it.
Yeah.
I mean, that may not have been the intent, but that's the reality.
Okay. Henry has is looking at the funds and revenue collected, you know, in relation to our estimate. Talked about, you know, the comparison to the prior year, but this is the comparison to the estimate. And we did well on all the funds. Even with the boat decline, that I discussed, we still actually exceeded our estimate in the hunting and fishing license sales, which brought us over the estimate. The state park fund at 109.9%. There were some royalties and other revenue sources that helped us in that category. Local park fund at 125.9%. Some of that is interest earned. The additional revenue above is interest earnings on that fund, and there was a federal receivable there. The other category is several funds rolled up together, and they all did fairly well, as you can see. So let's switch gears a little bit and talk about just the budget, the 06 budget. And these are adjustments that basically took us to what I'm calling our year-end close, which was as of the end of November is when these numbers were run. There were some sizable adjustments to our budget, as you can see. We reduced the budget by $58.6 million, and there are various categories there. I'm going to just mention the top three. Unexpended balances were showing $39 million decrease. Roughly $30 million of that is construction, related to construction, and that has already been rolled into the 2007 budget. There's a five-year period to work on construction projects, so it's not unusual to see balances roll forward, but we do have some work to do there in getting those balances spent in 07, and I'll talk about that more a little bit when we talk about that quarter. The unissued bonds and receivables, that $15 million is basically the hatchery bonds. And those revenue bonds, we believe, will be approved by the Bond Review Board shortly, and they should be issued, I think, in February. The grants, that's primarily federal grants at $7.3 million. Several of those grants, again, if the funds aren't spent in the current year, we just reinstate them in the following fiscal year, and we are allowed to carry forward those funds. So our adjusted budget is $263.1 million. And in looking at this slide kind of shows where we ended up and where we still have to go. We did end up utilizing almost all of the adjusted budget. We've got 2.3% remaining at $5.9 million. Of that $5.9 million, some of that includes revenues that were calculated at the end of the year relating to Rider 27. So $4.3 million of the $5.9 is going to roll into 07. So that really leaves on the table $1.6 million, which is less than 1% on the 06, which is that's pretty good. We don't want to go over. We've got a little bit of funds there if something unexpected comes up. So that's kind of how we closed the year. And if there are any questions, I'll move into 07. We do have good news all the way along, all through the receipting process. Y'all will be happy to hear about all this. So we'll start with state park receipts. At $8.3 million, we're up 13.1% or $958,000 over the last year's collection. All of the categories exceed the previous year. Most notable are facilities and concession revenue on this bar chart.
And just to remind commissioners, this starts September 1, so you do it 3 months.
And maybe
is this the hurricane?
We're going up now.
No, I understand.
This is money in the bank.
Previous year. What's the reason for the significant increase?
Oh, I understand.
Didn't have hurricane.
Just hurricanes, yes. Right.
Yeah.
If you look back at it, actually, and I'm sure Mayor will touch on this also, but the revenues in 07 are very comparable to the revenues in 05.
Yeah.
I noticed that.
Yeah.
06 was where we had the biggest, which was the September, October of 2005.
That's on the boat revenues, again, we're up there at $3.3 million, up 8.6% or $259,000. And again, all those categories have increased. Registration revenue is up 9.8%, titling revenue 3.25%, and sales tax is up 13%. We do continue to do that transfer, 15%, and right now that will be $421,000 through November. That'll go to State Park.
Mary, if we can just go back to the State Park receipts. in sometime in the near future, it doesn't have to be today or tomorrow, could you give us a breakdown of doesn't necessarily have to be by park, but if it could be by region,
we have that information that we can
and if within a particular region there is a star, you could name that one.
I do not have that detailed report in me today, but we'll take a look at it and report on it in the next meeting.
I personally would like to have that for some of my friends' benefit downtown.
Be happy to provide that, and I'll cover it a little more in more detail in the next review, or just highlight the stars.
Or, Commissioner, do you need sooner than that relative to what we're trying to accomplish in the legislature?
We can send
you
a report.
Well, yeah, before our next meeting. Yeah.
I think
I've got 181 plans down there.
Mr. Chair, could I have a follow-up question to that?
Sure.
And I may have missed this, but can we convert the daughters into people that have actually accessed parks? In other words, can we say that there's a trend of more people going into parks? Do we have that data?
We do have visitation data, and we do have trends on that as well.
Do you like that?
Yes, to where we can show that either more people are accessing parks or they're not, or see there's any type of a trend over the last 3 or 4 years. You know, we have the anomaly with the hurricane season, but I just wondered if we can say that really people are accessing parks more now than they used to or less.
Mayor,
why don't you get the cut of that to all the commissioners relative to our business with the legislature for the next few months and questions that we were receiving?
We'll get with Walt and we'll
that'd be great.
We will get to all of you. Okay. On boat revenue, I think I've pretty much covered that one. Move on to license sales revenue again. More good news here at $59 million. We're at 2.1. million in revenues, or 3.7%. All the categories are higher than the previous year. You can see basically we talked a lot about that those trends, and they're you know flowing. You can see pretty well the same way here in 07. In reviewing the number of licenses sold, again the number sold correlates fairly close with the revenues. And you can see the various categories there. Hunting is up, fishing is up. And combo sales are up, and relating to those military super combos, we're at 21,160, which is a 5.7% increase from the prior year at this same time. So it is popular. In looking at the revenue collections with all the good news I just gave you, we are doing well in referencing back to our estimates. You can see all the various percentages there. We're well over the 25% of the fiscal year elapsed, and even just comparing like on the game fish and water safety and where we were last year, we were at about 36%, and we're at 39% here. So it's all correlating fairly well, no surprises. On our summary of our budget adjustments here, you remember we talked about the $39 million of unexpended balances, $30 million related to construction, and that's already in the $295 million at the top. The remaining $9 million of unexpended balances, you see them moving in this report. The grants, again, there were several. There wasn't one notable grant to talk about. There were just numerous grants that were pulling into the budget. So we're at $310.9 million, and let's look at how we're spending. Again, here with, you know, 25% of the period through, there's no surprises to me. You can see the salaries and benefits are tracking right where they ought to be. Operating and equipment is slightly beyond, and that's just because we pay a lot of our leases and rentals and stuff at the beginning of the year. So, again, we're on track. We do have some work to do on capital projects, as you can see. And I know Steve has several projects running, and we'll see that balance decline throughout the year. And that concludes that.
A lot of the state of repair of our parks throughout the state, if we, from a budget standpoint, truly factor in what it's going to cost our park system back up to where it's the best park system in the United States, but where the state is currently in, what do we estimate that our total annual budget, what does that do to our budget to get us to where we need to be from a true funding to stay on top of these projects and to bring to the next level?
Well, for the state park component, we can refer to kind of what our exceptional item request is for state parks, and that for construction purposes, I believe it includes $25 million of additional funds beyond what we have for those purposes
per year.
Plus, Walt has said, plus another $4 million in minor repair.
And also, there's a lot of questions asking on this capital project. You can see we're behind going into 07. We were somewhat behind, you could argue, in 06. And one of the requests that we've gone to the legislature with as we're trying to expand these dollars that we receive for the parks is, if I got it right from Gene and Mary, it was 20 more people to go into our infrastructure department relative to getting on top of this. Because, you know, we've gotten some questions about, you know, do you really have the capability to spend the money as you get it?
Right.
And I think this is one of the things, so I asked Gene that this morning, indicated we do have FTEs and they're requested up to 20 people. Because if we can get these dollars, then obviously we've got somebody to oversee them, we get the bids out and follow up and get the projects done.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Peter. First, Steve. Steve, when the crunch, dollar crunch came last year, didn't we have to do away with some of our positions?
Yes, sir, we did.
Well, see, what this request is, we're not stacking people, and what we've got to tell those people downtown, we're not coming down there just stacking people on top of people. We're digging ourselves out of the grave.
Oh, I don't disagree. That's what, yes.
You know, yeah. Here's where we were. Now we're here.
That's right.
All we want to do is get back to here.
Well, we want to get back to there in a little better.
Yeah.
Thanks, Dave. Please, any comments you have?
Yeah, no, yeah. It's not enough to just get out of
this. Yeah,
not
all. We're not going to get it anymore.
Right. But, you know, when you're in a hole, like Will Rogers said, stop digging.
Yeah, well, good point. Good point. Yeah, we got to get this thing turned around, that's for sure.
Yeah, over the course of the last two bienniums, our staff's been reduced to by almost 50 FTEs. Last year was about 20, 23, but again, it's been a kind of a slow, you know, decline based on available funding. That's just been the predicament and the dilemma that we've been wrestling with. But we do believe that with the 20 or so additional FTEs that's included in our LAR, we'll be able to effectively manage this new, you know, inflow of money and keep projects in the pipeline, keep them moving.
But we need to remember that when we're talking to our friends.
Good point, Commissioner. No, you're right. Yeah. Because we will get asked that question. You know, why are you trying to answer me?
Because you made us lay them all.
Yeah. Out of that funding, what percent of that goes into the local parks grant program?
Out of this 25, none of that. There's a separate amount.
That's separate.
I believe in our request, we're at $20 million per year to add on for local parks.
Yes, sir.
That's additional over the existing five. So it's total 25.
Right.
So the big percentage is going right out to local.
We don't have to oversee that.
Yeah, and that's the beauty. Peter's, you know, he picked that up well from Ned. The beauty of those is we don't have the operating costs on those parks. That's money that's going right to the project on the ground, those local areas, and also in those parks.
The public see more readily.
Exactly.
That's correct. And I think also, you know, as you're working with your local folks wherever you are, make sure to remind them of that, that these dollars are not just to be controlled at the state level, but they'll go back into the local municipalities to spend.
And Peter, there's one support from that group of folks.
Right.
You know, if you look at it this way too, if you're talking $25 million of grant money that our folks would farm out to these different requests, that results in $100 million worth of parks each year.
Okay.
You know, $75 to $100 million by the time they put their matching money in it, which is usually 2 to 3 to 1.
Which is really important to these urban areas.
And that's Peter, you get the real nerve right there of these urban areas, these metropolitan areas. You know, it would be good to get into our record right now that during the last election that 4 out of the 5 metropolitan areas in the state of Texas passed by overwhelming majorities. There was only one squeaker, and the rest of them were over 60%. They passed $643 million worth of local parks and outdoor areas for those cities. So,
people want
to our friends downtown, you know, the metropolitan folks have spoken.
Good point. Good point. Any other questions, Commissioner? We probably better move this along.
I understand that. Well, you know, I'm a new finance guy. I like all the kids. Mary, thank you.
Thank you.
We're not going to give you a gavel yet.
Item number 4, Larry McKinney, license assessment review.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Larry McKinney, Director of Coastal Fisheries. A few months ago, Mr. Cook gave an assignment to a group of us from within the agency, an assignment for which we were appropriately grateful.
You just take a
look. They overwhelmed me with an appreciation.
What did you do to make Cook mad?
I'm going to try to get out of that doghouse. To take a look at our license, review all of our licenses, which is appropriate in the discussion you've just been having here.
Yeah. Yes, very much.
Mr. Cook gave us these charges to take a look at. One is to review all of our point of sale licenses on the system, to develop some recommendations to make them as simple as possible, and trying to make them easy for our constituents to use them, and to eliminate those things that were complex and programming and all of that. You know, in reality, this is not a very exciting, it's very difficult to make this kind of presentation, not very exciting, in fact, a kind of a mind-numbing experience to deal with. But the point is...
Those are the easy things to get past, by the way.
Okay, I'll take that as a hint real quick.
Exactly.
But the point is,
flip right through.
There's probably nothing else. There's probably nothing else that's more important to what we do in this agency. And just exactly what you were talking about earlier. The point of sale area is the place where all of our constituents probably first see us and deal with us year after year. And what we do there and what we provide is the basis of the revenue that Mary was just talking about. You spent all that time. This is the heart of it. And so trying to make sure that it's workable for our constituents as easy as possible and does everything we need to do is a big, big deal. And we have some folks that really know what they're doing, fortunately, not me included, but we had a large group on this in this assessment team, but this is the core of it right here, these folks here. Paul Hammerson in particular, I want to recognize, he was the secretary of this thing, trying to put all this information together, which we'll see in a moment, which I greatly appreciate, but all these folks really are key. And so as I'm going and making this presentation, if you see somebody stand up behind me, it's because, okay, you're starting to say something stupid, they're going to come up and correct. So I just told you to stand up and walk up here as quickly as possible as I try to do what we're going through. Our catalog has 164 different individual items. Our work group is going to recommend, after going through this, to eliminate 61 of those. We'll modify another 26, and we'll add 3 new ones that'll add some things. Basically, what we're talking about if we can get everything done, we'll reduce that by about 25% and hopefully make it a lot easier for everyone to use. And so from that perspective, it was actually an interesting project, and I now know more about that license system than I really ever want to know. But again, it's important. What we did now is so where we are is we've taken all those recommendations and we've sorted them into three categories. Those that require legislative action, those that you as a commission can do, and Gene McCarty is going to present those next and can begin to recommend some actions to take on them, and then some that we can just do as an agency and that we're moving forward on. We passed out to you this. This is what I was talking about, one of the things that Paul put together for us. This is basically the Bible. Has them all sorted out, any kind of, any question you can think of, I believe is the answer to here. We're going to use this as the basis of the presentation. Well,
Paul did the work, and you put your name on the
front? Yeah, I know that. I learned that from my father. He gets all the credit for his 50s. I get the credit for
it. Okay.
I want to make sure they got the recognition. And so let's just get started. I'm not going to go through this whole thing. I've picked out a few examples just to illustrate kind of what we're aiming at and things I think you might be interested in. For example, this first one here is on field properness. It's one that we think we can believe. Basically, we already have a license that allows people to hunt birds with dogs, and that's all this ever did. I'm sure there's a purpose for it sometime in the past, but we really can't figure it out. It's redundant. So get rid of it, and there's another license that can take its place. That's an example of what we're talking about.
Is Gene going to explain? I was going to ask you what legislative action means.
In order to, I'm sorry, that's my fault. Basically, these are recommendations we'd like to do, but because the wording of the statutes, we'll have to go to the legislature to get statutory change in order for us to delete this license.
This particular one will take legislative action.
All ones I'm going to talk about will require legislative action. Gene is going to talk about the ones that you all can do in association. Okay? Thank you for that. I should have explained that. Well, let's take a look at these now. There are a set of licenses, hunting co-op licenses and landowner's fees. In looking at these are licenses that originally were intended to help landowners get together cooperatively and manage their land together and hunt together. But in reality, it hadn't turned out to be that way. This has turned out to be a group of brokers that put these lands together and do the hunting. Landowners probably don't ever see this type of thing. We're not getting any information out of it. So one of the recommendations was to basically delete these licenses and direct our folks that participate in this into two other areas. We have they can participate in our Wildlife Management Association program or get a hunting lease license. Do the same thing, and we get the data, we learn about it. So the recommendation was, let's one simplify, get rid of a couple of licenses, but move our constituents toward licenses from which we can get information we wish to take management.
That actually moves towards one of our objectives in our 10-year plan, which is to encourage wildlife co-ops.
So you
just send a letter to all these people and say, no more hunting co-op license, start over.
Go to this other area. Exactly. Yeah. And, I had all this. This is all in your notebook. Just kind of push this on down to there's where the alternatives are.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And if we were to do that, then you no longer need this participant fee, which is $5, we can get rid of that. They don't have to pay that anymore because you don't need a license. That's what would happen as well. Okay? That's another example. Let's see what
anything that sells for $5, you need to get rid of.
$5
and 50 cents to give it to
them. All right. Let's take a look at this one. These are the you were talking about non-resident licenses and so forth. There's basically two types of non-resident licenses. There's the non-resident general hunting license. It's $300. That's basically the license you purchase to hunt deer, turkey, and fall, anything at all. Then when you purchase that license, you have to get the endorsements. Archery could be $7. Texas Migratory $7. Company Game Bird $7. And you get $7. So that takes care of folks that are interested in that. But there is another group of licenses. In fact, there's been three or four that you'd have to pick from if you're coming in the spring or not interested in deer. And so our recommendation is let's combine these into just one license, this non-resident special hunting license, which basically would then allow you to hunt spring turkey, hunt anything else, and also we would put the price such that you don't have to buy the endorsements to roll into that license. type of thing. So it just makes it simple. You have two licenses now, basically. It's not really, you get the general one and go hunt deer and dip it when you want to. Or if you're not interested in that, you're coming in the spring, here's the other ones you go to, rather than having three, four, six, seven. That would be the...
How about that? Would fishing be a separate license, or could that be part of this program?
Well, then we just get into combos, which we're going to talk about in a little bit later, super combos. That's where you begin to look at conjoining those types of things. But we have some recommendations on that as well. And consequently, if you just wanted the short term, 5 days, it's the same thing. We roll that all into one. Instead of having three different licenses now, we just have one, and you buy that 5-day deal, and you can have the spring turkey or whatever you want to do in that. So you have three options, actually, as an honorary general, special, or 5-day, and rather than having six or eight that you might have to try to pick from and decide which one you're looking at. And I hesitate to do this, but this is the one that some people refer to, our in-house call it the Cheney line proposal. Because it deals with making sure that all those endorsements are there. You don't have to worry about it. Buy one license, you're covered. And then, of course, if you did that, you can delete all of these. Sorry, the fisherman, I had to throw that one in.
You were
talking about the combo licenses. We took a look at this, and this is the next two items on here. Just things we haven't really gotten to the point where we want to make a recommendation yet because of complexities or issues that we have to deal with. But I want to give you a couple of examples. And here's one. You talked about the combos. One of the things that we would look at there is we think we'd like to just eliminate this particular combination hunting and fishing package. Just if you look at the trends, for example, they've been down. People are moving to the super combo. In fact, we would like to move people to that super combo, and this is probably what happened. Although it's down, of course, there's still a little under 100,000 of them sold. Before we come up here and eliminate, we need to make sure that we're not sending them off somewhere else. So there's some issues there that we got to look at as well. Okay. Another area, a one-day for hire fishing licenses. This is something that comes up when we're dealing with the head boats or the party boats, primarily offshore. When these folks come in, they leave the dock early in the morning. Their clients come up and get on the boat. And if they haven't got their license, they're going to try to find some 24-hour place to go get them or just get on the boat and go fishing. And the party boat guys, it makes a problem for them. We want to try to figure out some way to work with these head boat guys. They take out about 60,000 people a year. We want to come up with some way to make it easy for them to sell their license, put them on the boat, and go fish. Unfortunately, we can't figure out how to do that with a system. An easy way would be a paper system, or some endorsement type thing. But there's all kinds of problems with that as far as keeping track of auditing and those types of things. And so these are examples of where we're kind of technically fixed right now, but we're on our list to try to figure out how to do it in a way that we can meet audit requirements and that type of thing. So that's kind of where we're at. If you have any questions, Ken is back here. Ken Booth, who is the guru of all this thing, as you were talking about asking, as Gene was trying to say a while ago, and I'll make that point for Gene. He's going to. He's like me. He put his name on it, but it's Ken Booth and Paul Hammerson. They go and do all this work, so she knows this stuff. If you want to have some questions, I'll get her up here to answer.
They're issued licenses annually, correct?
I'm sorry.
So on the boats, they're issued licenses annually. I mean, perhaps they have a booklet or something, and they've got to turn in a log to get reissued the following year.
Well, they don't sell licenses for it.
If they did,
well, that was one of the ideas. One idea, for example, was to just sell them a boat license. Right. Don't worry about the individuals. Just sell them a license for their boat, and they're done for the year. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the license, and one of our directions, one of our concerns is to try to make our recommendations as revenue neutral as possible. We didn't want to lose anything to the department at this stage, unless that was a decision that you all made for policy purposes you were talking about. Well, the license that would be required for a party boat would be pretty steep to do it. But maybe there would be ways to, when we're looking, maybe a way to do it in increments or something like that. So we're open to any ideas. We don't have one yet, but we're looking at it.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going through that really, really quickly, but the booklet is there. Feel free as you have free time. Take a look at these ideas. These are important. These will affect our business, and any of the folks here, any of us will be glad to go through with any of those things with you at any time, and we try to lay that out in this catalog to give you some ideas of where we're going.
We're going to be looking for, on some of these, we've already made a few contacts. We're going to be talking to legislators, and some of them want to help us out on some of these issues. We've already got some ideas. You know, I can't say enough to, like Doc says, to thank Kim and Kelly and Paul and all the other people in the divisions. I mean, when you do a change like this, you got to be sure, well, what's the impact on the resource? What's the impact as far as enforcement? You know, what's the impact? Are the auditors going to come back 2 years from now and say, what are you guys, nuts?
Yeah.
You know? And of course, they do that occasionally.
Sure, do that anyway.
But still, we have to try to make these kinds of systems. I think, you know, like the chairman said, our goal here in this 10-year plan is setting out, you know, 5-10 years ahead of us constantly where we want to get to, how to get there, simplify this process. You know, we chatted a little bit the other day. I mean, you know, we like the railroad thing where we did the kids ride for free, you know, and at first it was like, well, wait a minute, what's the financial impact of that going to be? Well, the end result is the financial impact has been wonderful.
Yeah.
We've got more people paying to take the kids free.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, can we do something like that with these heads? Yeah. You know, can we do something that not only helps us out bottom line, but makes it easier for those folks to bring the family? And, you know. So we're looking at a lot of different options. Any thoughts you've got, don't hesitate to give it to us.
Let me just mention a question here before. And I'm way outside the chart, but I've always felt that if we would have a licensing system comparable to our driver's license, where if I signed up for a super combo this year, I would automatically get assigned a number, day one, like a social security number. And then on an annual basis, or semi-annual basis, or every 2 or 3 years, or whatever, would then automatically bill that person. And it would be a plastic hunting and or fishing license, to where you then, it's kind of like the driver's license. We take the initiative and send it to them, and in the absence of their payment, then you lose it. But you've got a permanent ID number, your number is X number, just like your DL, and it's a lot easier for the consumer, because they get it, oh yeah, I just realized it expired, and here's my check.
No,
just a thought.
Those are marketing type things that we need to be looking at.
Nobody else might be doing it, but you know, it would make it simpler. The only problem with that would be, and you could have a maybe only for super combo people, the people that we know are really dedicated that will continue to just be part of the system.
Well, we are doing a number of things right here. I mean, and just very quickly, leading back to your previous discussion, you were talking about flatness of sales, which it has been. But I've given talks on this pretty regularly, and I'll dig this data up for you. Overall, some national comparisons, and this is for fishing altogether, saltwater and freshwater, that when we've done comparisons done between the big three, California, Florida, and Texas, over this period of time that they did, it's probably 2 years ago, fishing or license sales were down 1.5-2% in Florida and California, and they were up 2.8% in Texas. So in some places we bucked the trend. So we're doing some things right, but we can sure do better if we can make it simpler, and that's the goal. And I think Gene will follow up with more concrete proposals you can have to put that out.
Any other questions, Commissioner? All right, thank you.
Okay.
Committee item number 5, license fee and structure changes. Permission to publish.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, for the record, my name is Gene McCarty. I'm Deputy Executive Director for Administration. And while we're on the record, I do have one of these documents, which is the license trend, 20-year license trend for each one of you. I'd like to clarify that, again, Kim Dudish needs her name on this document. Her and her staff did a great job of putting that together. We have 10 years of data electronically. So getting the 20 years of data that goes back beyond our electronic license system that really creates a crunch of getting data updated into the existing system, which the request kind of drove us to do. So now we do have 20 years of data electronically. So
that one's fancier than the one you gave me.
Well, I'm going to give you a fancy one. The item before you is a request to publish several proposed changes to the hunting and fishing license structure. As outlined by Dr. McKinney, the department's license review team has developed a number of recommendations. To simplify and streamline the license structure. The following require commission action, and we're requesting permission to publish. First, we would propose to combine the resident commercial fishing license with the non-resident commercial fishing license. This would reduce the license count by one, do away with one license. We have a very few number of non-resident commercial fishing boats. It has a very minor revenue impact of approximately, we lose about $1,200 in the deal, but it's well worth it in terms of just reducing license count and simplifying things. Secondly, we would recommend to combine the resident freshwater fishing guide license with the non-resident fishing guide license. We don't necessarily get any significant data from separating those two. Both licenses are priced the same, so this would just reduce their license count by one. Thirdly, we would recommend renaming the resident and non-resident saltwater fishing guide license. This particular license is actually an all-water license. If you buy this license, you can fish in any waters of the state, or you can guide in any waters of the state, so it's actually an all-water license. This does not change the count, but it does clarify the intent of the license. This one is going to end up with adding a license, but it's going to give us some very valuable data in terms of one of the things that we're all interested in, and that's youth. We would propose to split the special resident hunting license into a resident senior hunting license and a youth hunting license. Right now, if you're over 65 or under 17, you buy this special resident hunting license. This would allow us to be able to distinguish between those two groups. We would recommend to delete the resident July-August fishing package. This license was created a number of years ago when we did some changes and quit rolling your eyes. to take the place of a 14-day fishing license that we had, it was an effort to try to provide an added benefit to the customer. It just really has not worked out. We don't have a large constituency for that license. Eliminating that license would reduce our license count by three.
Something you didn't favor one time. I did favor.
We had a lot of conversation about it.
Does the laughter have anything to do with whose idea it was?
We can't find the body of that.
No one's taking credit. Huh?
Right.
Next, we would recommend to combine the resident day plus and the repurchase of a license and just create a single one-day fishing license. You want to go fishing for one day, you buy a one-day fishing license. You want to go buy for the second day, you buy another one-day fishing license. We would exempt everybody from the requirements of having the stamp and just simply sell the license. This comes under what you were talking about earlier, Commissioner Montgomery, in terms of just trying to make the entry into this outdoor activity as simple as possible. You don't have to know whether you're fishing in freshwater, saltwater, or all water, et cetera, et cetera. You don't have to worry about repurchase and all that. So it's just a mechanism to simplify things.
They still have to have the freshwater staff at
a No, we would exempt if they would be exempt. If you were buying a one-day license, you would be exempted from the stamp. And you just pay your price for the one-day license. We would recommend a price of $10 for this license, one-day fishing.
How many of those will we sell?
We've been selling about 102,000 licenses. Plus about 9,000 to 10,000 of second day licenses. So, and then, however, the way our license system works, of that 102,000, that represents actually 1.4 days. So you can multiply that up. We're going to be talking about 150,000 licenses there. And if we simplify it, our expectation and hopes is that it will that license will grow.
Is that the lineup of what?
They're New Mexico, Colorado are $8 a day. Florida, I believe, is $15 a day. California is $12. That's my memory is correct. We would recommend to do the same thing with the non-resident license. Basically, just if you're want a one-day fishing license, buy a one-day fishing license. One-day fishing license would be exempted from the requirements of the tag or of the stamp, and we would price that at $15. Again, these are designed to be basically revenue neutral. In both of these, you would reduce your license count by 6. And lastly, we would recommend to begin to charge a fee for the bonus red drum tag, simply for the purposes of recovering administrative costs. And we issue about 5,400 of those bonus tags a year. And if you were keeping count on the license count, this whole package would reduce the license count by 10.
Do you have a number for administrative savings?
Administrative savings.
How much money does that save us as far as?
No, I don't. We'd have to go in and look at what we're paying on each transaction. We pay a transaction fee, and we also pay a vendor fee. We'd have to go in. I don't have that, but I can get that for you. And if you haven't, that is all I have. And if you have any questions.
Any questions? Any discussion? Okay. Where are we? I guess then I will authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Thank you, Gene. With that, committee item number 6, repeal the fee for proof of ownership of boats and motors. Francis Stiles. Mr. Francis Stiles.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Frances Stiles. I'm with the Administrative Resources Division and the manager of the Boat Titling and Registration Section. I'm here to request permission to publish a rule change concerning boat information. Under Parks and Wildlife Code, all boat ownership information is currently public information. Under the Texas Administrative Code, we currently charge a $2 fee and a $10 fee for boat ownership information. The $2 fee is current ownership information, and the $10 fee is for historical ownership information. So what is this? This is a request to publish the removal of the $2 ownership fee from the Texas Administrative Code. In January of 2006, Parks and Wildlife implemented the first phase of the new automated boat system. due to the improved functionality of the new system, the ownership report process has been streamlined. We're requesting to remove the $2 fee from the current ownership information for vessels or outboard motors in order to proceed with the implementation of internet ownership reports and registration renewals online. For your information, I've prepared this slide. This gives you an example of what information we provide when someone asks for ownership information. On the left-hand side, it will tell you either vessel or outboard motor information, gives you a description of the asset, whether the asset is titled or non-titled, and whether there is registration on this asset. At the bottom, if there a lien was on this asset, the lien holder would be displayed. This is a Texas Parks and Wildlife boat, so there's no lien holder on this. On the right side, you would see owner information, which is the current owner of record. If there were additional co-owners, those are also listed. So this is information that we have been providing and currently provide right now. And this is the type of information that would be available online. So why do we need to do this? Three reasons. One, to improve our services to the public and constituent groups by offering it on the Internet. Currently, Parks and Wildlife licenses a little bit more than 1,000 marine dealerships. Those folks are open at, during the evening, on the weekends. Having this information available to them online would help them determine true ownership when they're looking at trade-ins. Towing services are required to notify current owners within 5 days of towing an asset. Storage companies, if they need to file a storage lien, they are also required to get asset information. And additionally, for the general public, the person that wants to go out and buy a used boat from somebody could now have access to know if that part, if that deal is really true, get too good to pass up or not. Who would tell them who really owns that boat? Additionally, the cost of collecting the information or collecting and accounting for the revenue as far as credit card charges and reconciling and refunds would reduce the amount of revenue that we currently receive to almost an insignificant level. And last would be to keep up with industry standards. Right now, and for at least the last 3 years that I know of and probably before that, any vessel that is federally titled through the Coast Guard, that information, the ownership information, is available on the Internet. We have used that since we started registering those documented vessels. The Coast Guard has a website that provides ownership information, and the NOAA, National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Association, also provides that information, and we've been accessing that. Additionally, TxDOT is planning for a rewrite of their system and planning to have some form of ownership information available online as well. So what is needed is permission to publish this requested change in the Texas Register.
Any questions? Okay, thank you. I will authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sure. Sure. Mr. Cook, is there any other business to be brought before us?
I don't believe so, sir.
Commissioner, any other questions, discussion? Okay, with that.